This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 9th of August 2013. Hello and welcome to the Winchester Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle dated the 8th of August 2013, which this week has been edited by Jean Carswell, Ken Clemenson and Barbara Chase. Our readers today are Margot Meredith.
Hello.
John Richards.
Hello.
And Peter Lydiard.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, John Parker. We've received from Hampshire Trading Standards Service a bulletin about scams. Scams are ways that people try to extract money from you illegally. So I'll just mention some of these so that you're aware if you are approached, and just to be very, very careful. First one they mention is something called inheritance scams. The scammer makes contact normally by post or email, alleging that there is a large inheritance left by a distant relative or unknown benefactor who has died overseas. And they quite often ask you to need to pay money and provide personal details to access this. Never give your credit card, bank account details or copies of any important personal documentation to anybody you don't know or trust. You may get an unsolicited phone call about an alleged virus on your computer. Do not engage in conversation because they're trying to sell you things which you don't need. Don't engage in conversation. Hang up immediately. If you feel pressured to act, to disclose personal details and send money to a stranger, this is certainly a scam. Another one is a bank transfer scam. The scammer will phone and allege that it's come to the bank's attention that there have been some irregularities with your account, and they then ask you to phone the bank. Now, if you do this, they will not have got off the line, and any conversation you have thinking it's the bank will actually be with them. So if you get a scam of this nature, do not make any... do not try and phone back or try and phone the bank back immediately. Make contact with your bank, because the banks have advised us that they will never ask customers to transfer funds or disclose their passwords. The best way is to end any suspicious calls immediately and do not give out personal information. And then there is a further one, which is to do with shares. Scammers access information on shareholders from a public register and offer to purchase a percentage of the shares. This is normally, they offer to do this by fax. Do not respond to any offers of this nature. So there are five tips to protect yourself against scams. Do not give out any personal information to organisations or people before verifying their credentials. Do not click on a link in an email if you are unsure of its source. Do not respond to any offer that seems too good to be true. Do not send money or pay a fee to claim a prize or lottery winnings. And do not phone any phone number starting with 090. They are charged at a premium rate and can be very expensive. So if you have any concerns that phone calls or communications that you are receiving are scams, i.e. people trying to get money from you illegally, contact the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline on 08454040506. That's the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline on 08454040506. I hope that information has been helpful for you. So just be very much on your guard. Lighting up times. Today, Friday the 9th of August, the sun rose at 5:45 in the morning and will set at 8:40 in the evening. And Wednesday of next week, the 14th of August, sunrise will be at 5:50 in the morning and sunset will be at 8:30 in the evening. If you know of somebody who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or you have any problems with your memory stick or your player, the person to contact is Lynn Parker on 01962 862 826. That's 01962 862 826. There's a laminated card with this information inside each wallet should you need it, but please leave the card inside the wallet when you return it. Now to the news of the week. The main headlines are Council racking in millions for drivers, from drivers, revised scheme for city estate unveiled, and fracking dangers are simply, quote, myth peddling. So we start with the story behind the first headline.
Councils raking in millions from drivers. Motorists will fuel the coffers at Winchester City Council by more than £3 million in the coming year, the Hampshire Chronicle can reveal. The council is set to rake in £3.17 million from parking charges and fines in 2013-14, a projected increase of £409,000 on the previous year. Communities and Local Government Secretary Eric Pickles has waded into a row about council parking charges, pledging a crackdown on, quote, unfair town hall parking rules, unquote. The law is clear that parking is not a tax or cash cow for town hall officers, said Mr. Pickles. But City Council leader Keith Wood dismissed the figures as fallacious. Yet information gathered by the RAC Foundation put Winchester's net income from parking for 2012-13 at £2.758 million, while Southampton, a city several times larger, saw an income of £3.546 million. Other authorities projecting soaring returns include Test Valley, up £159,000 to £1.1 million, and the Isle of Wight, up £108,000 to £2.6 million. But some, like Fareham, down £429,000 to £1.3 million, and New Forest, down £13,000 to £1.1 million, are predicting a fall for 2013-14. Chris Gillam of Winchester Friends of the Earth said charges for central car park should be even higher. What is necessary is parking charges which make motorists choose the park and ride, he said. I don't see why the council should not raise income on its assets. I should think it's perfectly entitled to do so. And if it's using its income to encourage other forms of transport, that seems perfectly reasonable to me, he added. But the Institute of Advanced Motorists say there is a lack of transparency surrounding reinvestment among councils. The response we often get is that the money is being reinvested into roads, but where we have looked into that, the amount that councils are putting into things like road safety campaigns does not seem to be on the same level as the increase for parking charges, a spokesman said. Steve Gates, chairman of the Winchester Area Committee of the Hampshire Chamber of Commerce, said, "One issue that we need to understand is what the city is spending the money on. Where is it actually going to? The increases in parking charges have gone up faster than increases in pay locally, and it will start to eat into the disposable income of people who work in Winchester." Labour City Councillor Chris Pines also questioned how the income is spent. "Parking has got to pay its way, but we should not be ripping off people who have got to come into Winchester. Why can't we find a better way of using park and ride better? It's just an idea, but as well as shoppers in the city centre, the bus could go around the industrial estates at Winnell and stop a whole pile of congestion in the morning in Eastern Lane." The county's town halls are expecting to bring in £16.3 million, up £849,000 on the last year's income of £15.4 million. The net income is calculated from total charges and fines minus administration costs and parking patrols. But Councillor Wood defended Winchester's policy, saying, "The figures are fallacious. I do not know how they've arrived at that figure. We increased parking charges by 1% last year. We're taking as relaxed an approach to parking as we can, but we need a balance, and people should stay for the time they have paid for. Councillor Wood also said income from car parks is invested in services like the Park and Ride scheme, and that there is no surplus made on parking fines.
Revised scheme for city estate unveiled. Detailed plans for Stanmore revamp due soon. Revised plans for 150 new homes on a Winchester council estate over the next decade have been unveiled by city leaders. The aim is to revamp Stanmore, which is among the three poorest areas in the country, provide more family homes and better community facilities, including possibly a health centre. But proposals to turn parts of Summers Close and Cromwell Road recreation ground into housing and knock down some existing properties could spark further controversy. Ward member Councillor Jamie Scott said more detailed plans would be decided by the end of this month. He said, "I know a lot of residents were worried by the initial consultation and some of the options presented. Whatever we do, we must make sure we are consulting with residents." A council spokesman said no decisions had been made over sites and units yet, but that the new Queen's Headland was a priority. He said, "We are not proposing any specific numbers or indeed any specific sites anywhere else at this stage, as the framework action plan has yet to be taken to our cabinet. Once there are proposals to view, we will share them, first and foremost with the households and organisations that are in the immediate vicinity." The future of the City Council-owned derelict new Queen's Head pub in Stanmore Lane remains uncertain. Central to the master plan was building a new community centre on the cleared pub site, or extending the Carroll Centre in Summers Close. People were asked for their views last March. One option was moving the Carroll Centre, 8th Winchester Scout Hut and Stanmore Community Association Hall to a modern building on the pub site. But trustees at the Carroll Centre have now said they don't want to move, which leaves the council with the problem of what to do with the pub it bought for nearly £1 million. Councillor Scott added he would like the Carroll Centre to remain where it is. He said, "It's still young in building terms, and it has really reached out to the community. It's changed from being something for children to having a real community function for Stanmore." The Scouts are set to meet with the council later this month to discuss the future of their site. The spokesman added the council had not decided whether to use the pub for housing, as planning or policy requires considering the site for community use. As revealed by the Hampshire Chronicle earlier this year, City Council consultants had initially suggested Stanmore had the potential for 413 new houses and flats over the next decade. But proposals to build 200 houses and flats in tree-lined Wavell Way have now been dropped after the public consultation. The authority is pushing ahead with building 35 homes in the valley at Wilberforce Close, a project widely supported by locals. 7 garage blocks could also be turned into 25 Muse homes. Controversial proposals to build on parts of 2 recreation grounds and community gardens behind Selborne Place and Wickham Place are still in the master plan, despite protests from locals.
Fracking dangers are simply myth peddling. Minister, economic benefits to be considered. Hampshire people must accept fracking for shale gas, a senior government minister has said, describing the supposed dangers as myth-peddling. Business Minister Michael Fallon said it was likely that even more gas reserves would be found across the south than currently believed, and he urged residents to recognise the big economic boost, including lower energy bills, from exploiting the new technology. Mr. Fallon pointed out to the fact that twice as much shale gas had been found under the northwest of England as initially thought, and he said the same survey is now being done of the southern base, roughly from Dorset through Hampshire, Sussex, Surrey and Kent. We will know in March whether there is much more than was originally thought. Mr. Fallon added, if we can extract the shale gas as cheaply and efficiently as they have done in the United States, everybody benefits. The bullish stance will alarm opponents of fracking, which involves blasting underground rock with deposits of water to release trapped pockets of gas. The Hampshire Chronicle revealed in May that 8 drilling licences for possible fracking had already been issued to gas companies at sites across South Hampshire. But the alarm has been raised over groundwater contamination and toxic air around sites. In the Blackpool area, fracking was blamed for causing small earthquakes. George Hollingbury, the Tory MP for Meon Valley, warned it could be disastrous in the Hampshire Downs, which relies on groundwater and extraction from rivers. Mr. Fallon admitted fracking would cause disturbance, adding, "It's right the community should be compensated. That's why there's a compensation to the community of £100,000 per exploration well, and then 1% of profits, which could amount to several million pounds." But the minister dismissed scare stories about shale gas, saying there is no evidence that fracking leads to groundwater contamination. "We have a very robust system of regulation in place to control emissions and ensure it is done safely." Mr. Fallon urged developers to engage early with communities affected, adding, "They need to deal with some of the myth-peddling about and show people it is safe and that there may be considerable benefits." The minister was speaking after the furore over the Conservative peers' comment that desolate areas of the north-east, rather than the south, should be targeted for fracking. Dismissing that attitude, Mr. Fallon said, "It cannot be right to confine it to areas of the industrial north. It is unlikely that all 8 Hampshire sites would be fracked, which includes north of Winchester, from Kingsworthy towards Stockbridge, even if drilling went ahead, because many of the potential to generate conventional gas instead."
That concludes the headline stories, and we now continue with the death announcements. And it is with great sadness that we have to report the death of Richard Green, who for 5 years was the treasurer of the Winchester Talking newspaper, and he only stepped down from this position at the last AGM. Richard died on the 3rd of August at Southampton General Hospital, aged 66. And we send from the Winchester Talking newspaper our sincere condolences to his wife, Maggie, and to all the family. The other death announcements now follow. Battle. Beryl Battle, née Pierce, at Flowerdown Care Home on the 31st of July, aged 91. Corbett, Richard, known as Dick Corbett, on the 2nd of August at Countess Mountbatten Home, aged 78. Eddleston, Juliet Frances Eddleston, on the 30th of July, aged 86. Edmiston, Lucy Edmiston, on the 27th of July, aged 97. Goodrich, Betty Veronica Goodrich, on the 24th of July at Nuffield Care Centre, Redhill, Surrey. Halford, Ken Halford, on the 26th of July. Hill, Grace Amy Hill, on the 1st of August in Westacre Nursing Home. Johns, Pamela Johns, on the 5th of August, aged 85. Lawrence, Jean Lawrence, on the 26th of July, aged 93. Nunn, Walter Henry, known as Walt or Wally Nunn, on the 31st of July, at Winchester Hospital, aged 78. Trod, Doreen Joan Trod, at Old Alsford Cottage on the 28th of July, aged 82. And now we have Christian comment.
And this week it's written by Mary Gray, and she entitles it Reverence for the Sea, Now and in Ancient Times. August holidays are with us again, whether they are spent at home or away. I am writing this from Brittany, from a peninsula which has many links with home. Not only is it a haunt for many people from Britain today, over 1,500 years ago, Celtic monks from Wales and Scotland took to the stormy seas, not with the comfort of today's Brittany ferries, but in frail wooden coracles. For us in Britain, the names of Patrick and Brigid of Ireland, or Columba of Iona, are familiar. Here, and I presume she means Brittany, the names of St. Malo, St. Samson, St. Dol, and St. Gildas, and others, have given their names to towns and abbeys. Gildas, who died 60 years before St. Patrick and is buried in the Abbey Church, came from Scotland, seeking solitude and to preach Christianity to the Celts of Brittany. His memory is especially cherished on this peninsula. We recall Celtic spirituality at a time when nature is threatened. Its high point was a reverence for water, trees, animals and birds, all blessed as part of God's good creation. This tradition is very much alive in Brittany. Last Sunday, for example, at the port of St. Gildas, the Eucharist was celebrated in the open air by the port with hundreds of people present. After the service, everyone descended to the boats, which were blessed for the season. Then we turned to the sea, remembering that for us on holiday, the sea is a source of pleasure. But more importantly, the sea was highlighted both as a source of life and sustenance and also a cause of death through shipwreck or drowning. We prayed for the sailors and all who take to the seas for pleasure or for work, like the fishermen who depend on the sea for a livelihood. We acknowledged the need to respect the limits of the sea and refrain from overfishing, as well as polluting. And already some fish is being imported from places like Brazil because of the ignoring of limits. And of course, there is still an older tradition. Reverence for the sea, its power and its gifts, recalls for Christians the Sea of Galilee, by whose shores Christ called his first followers all fishermen. There he revealed himself as the high point of creation, in the stilling of the storm, in the miraculous catch of fishes, and in walking on the water. Still today, in Galilee, Brittany, and wherever we travel, discovering the presence of Christ in, and here is a verse quoted, the willing wind's tempestuous shocks, the stable earth, the deep salt sea. Around the old eternal rocks is our invitation and our challenge.
Next, we have the letters to the editor of the Hampshire Chronicle. If you yourself would like to send a letter to the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by either telephoning 01962 860 836, that's 01962 860836, by emailing letters@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, that's letters@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or writing to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. That's 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. So now we have the first letter,
which is from John Mile, who says, "No consideration for beauty spot. Sir, Chris Corcoran, letters August the 1st, says I paint a dismal picture of Twyford Meads. He is probably right, but it is partly a reality. The amount of rubbish left there beggars belief. He mentions that the parish council bought Berry Meadow so it is available for those who wish to enjoy its beauty, but it's in danger of being spoilt. However, he voices some of my concerns. Perhaps bins would encourage those who use it to dispose of their rubbish responsibly. It is great that volunteers clear up, but why should they have to? On Saturday, I found 8 youths camping by the fallen willow tree. They were striking camp, and there was rubbish all around and a smouldering fire. There were countless plastic bottles, food packaging and lots of beer bottles, some broken, over a large area, and wet towels they couldn't be bothered to pick up. I asked them, politely, to ensure they took away their rubbish. I was met with abject insolence. I returned as they were leaving and asked, not so politely, why they found it so difficult to pick up their rubbish. I got a similar response. Between 1979 and 1985, I was village police officer at Twyford. I would patrol the towpath and the meads to try to ensure such nuisance was controlled. Village police officers are a thing of the past, so there really is no one to control this. Chris asks if the tree should be removed. The simple answer is no. Why should the users of this beautiful area be punished for the inconsiderate and dangerous actions of these people?" That's from John Mile, Colden Common.
This letter is from Andrew Smith, and it's headed, "Britain's countryside is irreplaceable. Sir, the countryside is increasingly at risk from inappropriate development caused by inadequate planning policies, a weakening of local democracy, and focus on short-term economic growth regardless of the environmental consequences. The government's localism agenda has been undermined, and I am concerned that local views are being ignored to the detriment of irreplaceable countryside. While I recognise the need for economic prosperity, this should be pursued at any cost to the environment. We don't stand up for the countryside, we will lose it. I urge readers to sign the Campaign to Protect Rural England's Charter, which demands better protection, a fair say for local communities in planning for the places where they live and work, and more homes in the right places." That's from Andrew Smith, Silverdale Road, Tadley, Basingstoke.
And Roy Faithful writes a letter. "Worship is part of nation's heritage. Sir, how ironic that the recent article on HMS Minerva appeared in the same issue as the item in Belgarum entitled What Winchester Nearly Lost. Minerva M33 was built in 1915, following the outbreak of war, as an M29 class monitor. Her construction truly was rapid, being ordered in March, launched in May, commissioned in June the same year. Designed for coastal bombardment, she had a shallow draft, and her main armament consisted of 2 6-inch guns. She first saw active service in support of the landings at Gallipoli in August 1915 under Lieutenant Commander Preston Thomas. Remaining at Gallipoli until the evacuation in 1916, she served with the Mediterranean Fleet and was involved in the seizure of the Greek fleet at Salamis Bay on September 1, 1916. Were it not for Hampshire County Council purchasing her as a retired floating office or hulk, an important part of naval history would have been lost. This would have been upsetting with the centenary of the Great War about to be commemorated. Surely preserving heritage is not, quote, frittering away, unquote, public money, nor spending it on fripperies. The Mary Rose, Victory, Warrior, and the two motor gunboats at Portsmouth Historic Dockyards have been joined by a worthy sister, thanks to the council's intervention because lottery funding was not available at the time. Public interest in all of these exhibits is demonstrated by high attendance at the site. Roy Faithful, Hairstock, Winchester.
This letter is from Christine Holloway, who is Director of Winchester Action on Climate Change. And she says, city could reap double benefit. Sir, even more important than the location of a new leisure centre in Winchester is its long-term impact on the environment. The architect's brief should require a design with the smallest possible carbon footprint. If it is well insulated, perhaps the centre could capture enough heat from people exercising to heat the pool. The council would demonstrate its commitment to cutting its own carbon footprint and increase its income by generating solar power on the roof. And our children and grandchildren get a double benefit, a top quality sports facility and less global warming. That's from Christine Holloway, Director, Winchester Action on Climate Change, Sparkford Road, Winchester.
Another letter about the recreation centre. This is from Nick Ray, and it's headed, why is it so hard to find 5 million? Sir, if Keith Wood and his colleagues on the City Council can't find 5 million to fund the gap between the £30 million leisure centre Winchester needs versus the £25 million centre it can afford, then I'd question their competence. The County Council is sitting on £419 million in reserves, of which only 1% would cover the shortfall for a facility that serves not just Winchester, but significant parts of Hampshire too. Alternatively, there must be creative means to raise this amount in a county with a gross expenditure of £1.8 billion. Mr. Wood, in his unambitious letter of July the 11th, said, for everyone who wants a 50-metre pool, there is one who doesn't. But I would challenge him to show me evidence for this assertion. As an illustration, a 50-metre pool, as Sue Faulkner's letter, August the 1st, points out, is not about size per se, but increasingly overall access to facilities, too often unavailable when needed. A larger pool, for example, can be split and used concurrently for lane swimming and lessons, plus club facilities. And it's not just swimming, with insufficient provision at River Park for many facilities. I'm not sure if Mr. Wood is more of a body pump or a Zumba man, or indeed if he or his colleagues use River Park. But were he to try to book many classes, he would find it near impossible. For example, via the lamentable DC Leisure River Park online booking system, I find no availability for a Monday evening class I want to attend for the next 19 days. This despite paying for River Park twice in council rates and as a Connecticut member, forking out £50 a month. This is the experience of many individuals across many activities. Can £5 million really exercise Mr. Wood so much? It's from Nick Ray, Fordington Avenue, Full Flood, Winchester.
Councillor Kim Gottlieb writes that on calm tolerance, if not resignation. Sir, in his letter of August the 1st about this weekend's Boomtown Festival, Charlie Flint anticipates no action will be taken against illegalities, and that the behaviour of the council will be pathetic. Knowing the effort that has been put in by many council officers over the last several months, I know that Mr. Flint's claims are as incorrect as they are unfair. Boomtown at Matterley Bowl is in my city ward, and I know that a good number of my constituents are going to be inconvenienced, sometimes greatly, by the noise and traffic that is generated. On the other hand, most of them recognise that 30,000 people having fun at a festival is bound to create some disturbance and face that reality with calm tolerance, if not resignation. Broader afield, most folk know that any city worth its salt will have its own comparable event and that some mitigation is provided by the employment and economic activity also generated. At the event itself, there will be council officers with stopwatches, noise meters and clipboards crawling all over the place like a rash. Any illegality will be recorded and responded to in an appropriate way. The organisers have met many of the immediate neighbours and are ready to respond to any issue that might arise locally. Things will go wrong, but that's life, as is having to put up with other folks' noise, music, once a year. Councillor Kim A. Gottlieb, Black Farm, Avington, Winchester.
This next letter continues the theme of noise. And F.J. Barker says, complaints could fall on deaf ears. Sir, residents who feel the need to complain about noise, traffic, or anything else concerning this year's Boomtown event should be aware that there is no guarantee any complaint made to the official event hotline will be forwarded to Winchester City Council. The licence under which it is held contains no requirement to pass on complaints or details of noise measurements they carry out. The provision of this information is at the whim of licence holder and landowner Peveril Bruce. He did indeed provide the information to WCC last year, but refused to allow it to be released to the public. If you wish to ensure that your complaint definitely reaches Winchester City Council, you should ring 01962 865 405. That's 01962 865 405. Residents may also be interested to learn that there will not, as has been published, be any reduction in the thumping bass after 11 p.m. There is no requirement for this in the licence, and the organisers will not make a voluntary reduction. That letter is from F.J. Barker, Windermere Gardens, Alsford.
Roger Matthews writes, not enough hours in waking week. Sir, aged 65, I was alarmed to read, Hampshire Chronicle, August the 1st, that adults should get their hearts beating faster than usual for 150 hours per week. Assuming I reduce my sleep to 2.5 hours each night, my wife and I might still find it a challenge to maintain high activity each waking minute. Are we doomed? Roger Matthews, Friars Close, Kingsworthy.
And Mr. E. Mayer asks, is BID, that is the Winchester Business Improvement District, really worth the joining fee? Sir, last week's article about Winchester BID got me thinking about its role and purpose. Several small businesses have told me of their dissatisfaction at having no choice but to pay £220 for the, quote, privilege, unquote, of joining BID. The services they receive do not seem to justify this compulsory charge being imposed on them. Towns which do not have BID schemes still have ShopWatch schemes and informal meetings between businesses in partnership with the police and chambers of commerce. Most businesses are also quite good at self-promotion. They have to be. Why has BID done nothing to address the significant reduction in footfall caused by deregulation of the market? The services provided by BID do not really justify its existence. Like the deregulated market, it is really just there to raise revenue for the council and to fund itself. How much of the £180,000 raised goes on administration and salaries? In an independent survey If an independent survey were conducted on all the retail outlets in Winchester, how many would withdraw from bid if given a choice? E. Mayor, Chester Road, Winchester.
Why wind farms come in clusters, writes Marcus Stanton. Sir, Keith Story's assessment on each wind farm being a stepping stone is chillingly accurate, Chronicle Letters, July the 25th. In the developer's toolkit is the next phase argument that if a wind farm has been built, then the damage to the countryside has been done, and more will therefore not have a great marginal impact. This goes some way to explain why they tend to be built in clusters, and the other proposed wind farm at Woodmancote, not far from Bullington Cross. Peppering the countryside with wind turbines then becomes an opportunity for the developers, and all the more reason to object to these initial proposals if there are genuine and specific reasons for so doing, of which there are many. That's from Marcus Stanton, Norton Manor Lane, Sutton Scotney.
A.R. Hodson writes, Winchester never had a Hyde Park. Sir, on walking by the site of the old Winchester Laundry in Gordon Road, I see that it's been renamed Hyde Park Corner. But Hyde Park is in London. In Winchester, the park was called The Park, before it changed to Riverside. As it was built on the laundry site, it might be better to have called the old laundry, so we could remember what was on the site before. A.R. Hodson, Nuns Walk, Winchester.
Andy Dobson says, this road doesn't need a lower limit. Sir, I read with interest your article in the Chronicle of August the 1st calling for speed check findings to be published, and in particular the comments by the Lib Dems' future election candidate. Miss Porter says residents have called for lower limits. This sounds like there is an overwhelming voice on speed limits in the area, Springvale Road included, where the opposite is true. It would further appear that Miss Porter's election campaign has started early, since our sitting MP, Steve Brine, is on the case, having held numerous meetings with residents and highway agents. I wonder if sometimes certain parties would rather nothing changed so that they could continue with soundbites that have the opposition achieve anything. As for the questionnaire from Kingsworthy Parish Council about Springvale Road, apparently they didn't get the answer they wanted the first time, so are having yet another go. Springvale Road has a very low accident rate and doesn't need the speed limit cut, as this could make it more problematic through parking. There is no evidence for a reduction, as the police have already confirmed. Andy Dobson, Fraser Road, Kingsworthy.
We next come on to the items of historical interest. We have items from 200, 100, 50 and 25 years ago. The themes today seem to be either to do with the French or ecclesiastical matters, and in fact one of the items combines both of them.
And this first one from 200 years ago, that's August the 9th, 1813, is entitled Frenchman's Gallant Conduct. Freemasonry. On the 2nd of February, the French privateer Le Furet captured the Irish brig The Two Friends, when a short conversation commenced between the French and British captains, and the signals of masonry were interchanged between them. Then Mariencourt, the French captain, generously bestowed the prize with her cargo on Captain Campbell as a token of respect for the ancient and illustrious craft, and the British ship proceeded unmolested on her voyage. Several lodges testified their approbation of this gallant Frenchman's conduct.
100 years ago, August the 9th, 1913, College Chapel glass cast out. Letter from Arthur C. Benson, distinguished author and essayist and master of Magdalen College and brother of E.F. Benson to the Times, reprinted in the Hampshire Chronicle, deploring at Winchester College authorities' determination to cast out the 1821 glass from the chapel. One would have thought that Winchester, of all places in the world, might have learned, by burning their fingers so handsomely over their woodwork, not to tamper with their poor chapel and its successive decorations. It is true, I believe, that the warden and fellows, about 1875, broke down, cast out and sold, for less than £100, woodwork which has since been sold for £20,000. At the time, all the people of ecclesiastical taste were quite sure that they were right, whatever rightness means in a thing which varies so from century to century as artistic taste.
50 years ago, August the 10th, 1963, a letter to the editor. Sir, while visiting the tower of the cathedral with a young French friend, I was rebuked for translating for her the guide's commentary. Not only was our friend embarrassed at being the cause of this public rebuke, but, as it was to be expected, she was thoroughly bored for most of the tour, since the commentary was quite incomprehensible to her. It has always been my experience when visiting buildings of historic interest in Europe to be offered an English-speaking guide. Is it not time we offered some comparable facilities to our visitors?
And 25 years ago, on August the 5th, 1988, only one in three pay for cathedral. Winchester Cathedral could cope with another 100,000 visitors, perhaps 200,000. But the Dean, the very Reverend Trevor Beeson, said this week, "And we may have to go and get them on our own." The Dean said they must attract more visitors to the cathedral because its financial situation was quite precarious. "This has to be tackled in the next year or so," he said. "I am sure it can be done." In the course of the year, there are 400,000 visitors, but only one in three give the £1 suggested. Donations from the friends, money from the bookshop, and investments bring the income to £400,000.
Just as a comment on the item from 100 years ago, the woodwork from Winchester College Chapel referred to actually was retrieved and is now actually installed in Newhall at Winchester College. So it was not irretrievably lost. And, of course, the cathedral is in the news of late with having been granted £10 million lottery grant for the development of visitor facilities at the cathedral. Right, we next move on to the Hampshire Chronicle editorial comment.
And it's headed, "Diversification Key to Future of Farming." The Hampshire Chronicle reveals this week that the Royal Agricultural Benevolent Institution, which helps farmers in financial crisis, has come to the aid of almost as many farmers so far this year as for the whole of 2008, when the global financial crisis hit. It is often overlooked that Hampshire is primarily a rural county, with more than 1,000 farms and over 7,000 people employed in agriculture. Chris Cook, former chairman of the National Farmers Union Hampshire branch, who farms at Twyford and Durley, says it's the most challenging period for farming he's seen in 40 years. But it's not all doom and gloom. County pig farmers have unveiled their own range of charcuterie as part of the Preserving the Hampshire Hog project. The project was created and led by County Food Group Hampshire Fair and supported by Prince Charles's Countryside Fund. It is designed to tackle the challenges faced by pig farmers, including increasing feed costs and a lack of European funding. The diversification into new products extends the shelf life of the producer's meat through curing and adds value. It's this kind of innovation that will keep our farming industry alive.
Next, we have Westminster Diary from George Hollingbury, and that will then be followed by First Person.
So, George Hollingbury writes, "So, when is a farm not a farm? Answer, when it's a solar farm, and for many they're causing some controversy. Solar farms are similar in concept to the panels we all have seen on the roofs of houses. The difference is that these farms are most often located in the countryside and are of a rather different scale. How different? Well, there's an application being made near Stockbridge for one of 225,456 solar panels. That's the size of 200 football pitches. I think you can see why this might have the potential to cause a bit of a rumpus. Opinion on them is divided. Many people are broadly in favour of the panels as a source of energy. They provide low carbon energy and have the potential to play a part in reducing our reliance on imported fossil fuels. The site in Stockbridge will produce enough electricity to power about 12,000 homes, for example. Then there are those who consider them to be a blight on the landscape, and just another example of urban creep and development of the countryside by stealth. Many worry that if a solar farm is built, it'll be houses or worse next. And there are also concerns about wasting the potential of valuable agricultural land. So it's pretty clear that both the government and local authorities need to be very careful about how they deal with this issue and make sure they've thought the problems through. I thought I'd check to see if they have. And the news is encouraging. I met Nick Bowles, the minister responsible for planning, and he told me that the government wants to focus on locating solar farms on top of buildings and in utilising existing brownfield sites wherever possible. He also said that new planning guidance to local authorities will make clear that the desire for renewable energy should not automatically take precedence over environmental protection. And he was also clear that the establishment of a solar farm should not create any kind of housing development opportunity, and pledged to ensure that his department would make this clear to local authorities. Happily, the planning departments of our local councils told me that it is also their view. So it seems that those in charge are live to the potential problems, but that won't stop there being quite a few controversial applications in our beautiful Hampshire countryside. Watch this space.
And that brings us on to First Person, which this week is written by Khalid Aziz, who says, "There is always plenty of desperation around. I've been targeted by Wonga. I hadn't thought myself in the frame for such attention, being reasonably well off. However, it seems that the good people of Wonga are widening their net in an attempt to bring their financial solutions to a broader spectrum of society. In their kindness, they've emailed me, offering a £9,000 business loan over a period of 16 weeks. For this privilege, the interest and fees will be £900, amounting to an APR of well over 30%. I would have to be desperate and my business in a dire position to take this up. And yet, of course, that is exactly the unique selling proposition of such payday lenders: desperation. No one in their right mind would contemplate engaging in such high interest arrangements unless they were truly desperate. But there is always plenty of desperation around. When I was a child, there certainly was. Back then, payday lenders were shadowy figures, often linked with strong-arm tactics for those who didn't pay up on time. To my knowledge, we avoided them, but it didn't stop us patronising more traditional lenders of last resort, pawnbrokers. In reality, we had little to pawn. Jewellery, such as it ever was, had long gone. No one had even a watch to pawn. We did have a tea caddy with a thistle handle and some spoons, which, while attractive, did little to lighten the dead eyes of the pawnbroker. They raised precious little, but it tided us over for a week or so. Those days were well before regulation, and APR as a concept was alien. We were then, as so many are now, at the mercy of those who were more financially astute, and who could arbitrage the huge buy-sell margin. I was warmed by Archbishop Welby's credit union initiative. Banning last resort lenders only serves to drive such service providers underground, with all the unattractive add-ons such a move would engender. Better to offer the poor and desperate a reasonable alternative. And money in itself is not the whole solution. Credit unions require engagement by borrower and lender. They not only hand out funds, but offer genuine help designed to give borrowers a route out of dependency. It's understandable that elements of the media exposed the Church of England's investment policy as arguably at odds with the letter of Christ's teaching. Justin Welby's subsequent justification stood up to scrutiny and generated sympathy as he confessed to the fallibility of the complex investment policy of the church commissioners. The real test now will be whether he can move a church justifiably more interested in God than mammon to really get to grips with the latter when the chief beneficiary will not be the church itself. The poor will always be with us. But a measure of our civilization is how we help them not just with handouts, but with ways out of grinding poverty.
We now move on to items of general news interest, and the first two items relate to the Hampshire Chronicle editorial comment about agricultural matters.
Storm clouds gathering as farmers continue to struggle. Farmers in the region are still feeling the economic pinch, despite increasing signs the economy is picking up. Hampshire has well over 1,000 farms, and more than 7,200 people are employed in agriculture. They say unpredictable weather over the last 18 months has played havoc with cultivation and animal husbandry. Finely laid plans are being regularly wrecked, and the long winter and wet spring introduced extra costs such as animal feed, straw and labour. The everlasting cold meant cattle and sheep due for market in early spring were not ready. Farmers were faced with the dilemma of selling and getting £100 to £150 less than budgeted for per animal or holding, with all the extra costs in the hope that they might get a better price. Sally Fields, regional manager for the Royal Agricultural Benevolent Institution, that's RABI, which helps farmers in financial crisis, said many farming families are really struggling. Some have simply reached the limit of their ability to juggle finances and borrow more. Others are trying to deal with the fallout from last year's disastrous weather, which saw significantly reduced yields and incomes, as well as substantial rises in costs, such as animal feed and fertiliser. Within Hampshire, in 2008, RABI paid out £32,000 and helped 33 beneficiaries, a figure inflated by the small foot-and-mouth outbreak. To the end of May 2013, it has already paid out £25,000 and helped 27 beneficiaries, well on track to double the 2008 figure. A spokesman for the National Farmers Union said it had 1,000 members in Hampshire and many were feeling the strain, but they were conscious that things are even worse in the flood-hit West Country and parts of the Midlands. Chris Cook, former chairman of the NFU Hampshire branch and who farms Twyford and Durley, said there are a lot of people under pressure because of the way the weather has hit their cash flow. There is a mental pressure of dealing with the ever-rising overdrafts, though to be fair to the banks, they've been pretty good. But this has been the most difficult period for farming that I have known in 40 years. Mr. Cook said that he believed that there were a couple of farmers in the Winchester area who were teetering on the brink of disaster if the harvests are bad. But he added, "You can't be pessimistic in farming. Every day you have to get up and be optimistic."
Countess backs County Farmers Initiative. Hampshire pig farmers got another royal seal of approval when they unveiled their own range of charcuterie to the public at the New Forest and Hampshire County Show. The producers welcomed Her Royal Highness, the Countess of Wessex, to their stand, marking the culmination of the Preserving the Hampshire Hog project. The project was created and led by County Food Group Hampshire Fair and supported by Prince Charles Countryside Fund. It was designed to tackle the challenges faced by pig farmers, including increasing feed costs and a lack of European funding. The farmers have been trained by charcuterie expert Mark Frederick Berry and now create salami, chorizo, pate, brisaola and pancetta from their locally reared meat. This diversification into new products extends the shelf life of the producer's meat through curing and adds value. After chatting to the producers and sampling some charcuterie, the Countess unveiled a wooden plaque. Mike Wright, chairman of Hampshire Fair, said, "Hampshire Fair has worked closely with local producers to deliver an innovative project, and we are extremely proud of the outcome. Charcuterie is the artisan skill of taking raw meat and preserving it by curing, smoking, cooking, or in a combination of all three."
Youngsters to have say on policing. Police Commissioner launches new body. There are 28 youngsters who hope to shape policing in Hampshire as part of the newly established Youth Commission. Hampshire Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Hayes launched the new body at his headquarters in Winchester. The 28 young people who applied for the posts on the commission represent youngsters from diverse backgrounds from across the county and met for the first time to draw up a list of their priorities. A full programme of activities was arranged for the members on their first day together. The main focus was for them to get to know each other and to come up with crime and policing ideas around the issues they may want the Youth Commission to address in their respective areas. That led to the following priorities being agreed upon for them to work on: tackling offending and reoffending, improving the relationship of young people with the police, and that's looking at stereotypes from both sides, antisocial behaviour, drugs and alcohol, domestic violence and child abuse. Mr. Hayes said, "I thought this first meeting of the Youth Commission went exceptionally well. It provided everyone involved with an opportunity to get to know each other and to discuss the challenges they collectively face as a representative group. There was certainly a depth of quality within the group who had already given me an understanding of young people's view of policing and what life is like for them in today's society. Together they have a shared enthusiasm to make a difference, and I look forward to working with them all over the coming months." Actually, I put the emphasis wrongly there, I'm afraid. "I look forward to working with them all over the coming months." The scheme has been set up in partnership with the SHM Foundation, and if successful, will be rolled out across the whole of Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. The next meeting of the Youth Commission, next Thursday, that's August the 15th, which will see the launch of the Big Conversation, a three-month period during which the members will set out to canvass the thoughts of 2,000 young people in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight through workshops, events and informal conversations.
New Forest and Hampshire County Show. Royal couple can't get enough of show. Wet start, but holiday crowds flood into New Park. They visited virtually every inch of the showground and charmed everyone they met. The Earl and Countess of Wessex were the toast of New Forest and Hampshire County Show after spending almost 5 hours at the event. The royal couple had a cheery greeting for everyone, often stopping to chat with people they were not scheduled to meet. Mike Richards, this year's show president, said they were absolutely delightful and put everyone at their ease. As well as taking a really genuine interest in everything that was going on, they were very easy to talk to. I'm sure everyone they came into contact with went home very pleased to have met such a charming couple. After trying their hand at fly fishing, the royal couple split up in a bid to cover the whole showground between them. The Earl headed for the food hall, while his wife made her way to the Discovery Zone, where she watched 4-year-old Daisy Seward and her 2-year-old brother Jake enjoy a fencing session. The Countess repeatedly laughed out loud as the two children giggled their way through the session. Earlier, she launched a new business called Hampshire Charcuterie, formed by a group of pig farmers who are selling salami, pancetta and other products using locally reared meat. The royal couple concluded their visit by presenting 2 new awards devised by the National Park Authority and the Country Land and Business Association.
Couple raise life-saving funds. I'll read that again. Couple raise life-saving funds in honour of son. A couple have raised funds for life-saving equipment at Winchester's Royal Hampshire County Hospital's neonatal unit after their baby son died 30 minutes after birth. Becky Izar, aged 28, and her husband Paul, aged 30, want to help other parents with seriously ill children after they lost their first child. Their baby, affectionately called Peanut, suffered from an undetected tumour near his heart and lungs that stopped him from breathing outside of the womb. He died at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital on May the 23rd. Mrs. Izar gave birth to £3.15 Peanut when she was 31 weeks pregnant. Before he was born, there were no signs anything was wrong. Mrs. Izar from Cudworth Mead, Hedge End, said, "When I went into labour, the paediatricians and consultants said he had a good chance of survival, even though he was 9 weeks early. They thought he would be okay, although he would have to go to the neonatal unit. It was not until I gave birth that we were aware anything was wrong, because he was not able to breathe on his own. It was a terrible shock. Doctors battled to resuscitate their baby, but were unable to save him. He passed away 30 minutes after birth. A post-mortem examination revealed the undetected tumour. Mr. Izar said there was nothing they could have done. Even though their baby could not be saved, the couple are grateful for the support they received from doctors and midwives at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital. Mr. and Mrs. Izar, who have been married for 3 years, were allowed to spend a precious day with their son in a special unit in the maternity unit. Nurses washed and dressed their baby, and the couple took it in turns to hold him and say their goodbyes. The baby's grandparents also visited. Mrs. Izar added, "The nurses gave us a memory box. They took his hand and footprints to put in the box, and we have photos of him. They let us keep the hat they dressed him in." The couple nicknamed their son Peanut when Mrs. Izar was pregnant and hadn't come up with another name by the time he was born and died. Now, in just over 2 months later, the couple have raised £2,250 in their son's memory to buy a resuscitation trolley to help other sick babies. Mr. Izar and his 2 friends, Lee Kinchington and Alex Godden, did a 55-mile sponsored cycle ride from London to Brighton. Mr. Izar said, "There was nothing they could have done to have saved our son, but it's nice to think that in cases where there is something that can be done, the money raised will make a difference." Advanced neonatal nurse practitioner Mary Fitzmaurice, who accepted the cheque, said the resuscitation trolley had drawers which made it easier to access life-saving equipment.
Elderly at risk during home visits. Elderly people could be put at risk because 12,000 home care visits across Hampshire every week last just 15 minutes, a leading county councillor has warned. Liberal Democrat Alan Dowden fears some could be left suffering in loneliness because the council commissions short visits. Hard-pressed carers can struggle to complete a series of tasks, such as feeding elderly people and taking them to the toilet in that brief time slot. Councillor Dowden, Liberal Democrat spokesman for adult social care, warned frail pensioners can deteriorate rapidly, and this could be missed if there is no time for carers to stop and chat. The councillor, who has accompanied carers on home visits, said, "All those that I have visited said they would like the opportunity for a cup of tea and chat. Some of the clients only ever see the home carer and feel very isolated." He added, "There are, I am sure, individual cases where some 15-minute or less slots may be acceptable. However, mistakes could be made." Councillor Dowden has called for councillors on the All-Party Safe and Healthy People Select Committee to carry out an in-depth review. His call comes after a British Red Cross survey of GPs and members of the public revealed that older people are becoming increasingly isolated, the number of falls and accidents is rising, and there is growing pressure on the NHS. Councillor Anna McNair-Scott, executive member for Adult Social Care, said the council commissioned care for 7,000 adults from home care agencies. Most, 88%, home visits were 30 minutes or longer, with just 12% of 100,000 visits per week lasting 15 minutes. The Conservative portfolio holder said, "Furthermore, where 15-minute visits are part of the care plan, they are in almost every case associated with visits of longer duration at other times of the day. Indeed, only 1.7% of people with home care receive only 15-minute visits. That is 114 people out of the 7,000. These cases have been reviewed and are being reviewed again. Many are also supported in other ways, and most live in sheltered accommodation." In 2011, the council stopped commissioning 15-minute visits for personal care, such as washing and dressing. As a result, the number of 15-minute visits fell from 14% to 12% of the total. Council chiefs say 15 minutes can be appropriate to check someone has taken vital medication or when is reluctant to receive help. However, the Hampshire Chronicle has learnt carers are also expected to undertake other tasks, such as serve microwave meals and take elderly people to the lavatory in 15-minute care slots. As previously reported, the council is measuring care by the minute in a bid to save millions of pounds. It rolled out a new electronic monitoring system which precisely times when carers arrive and leave people's homes.
Council defends travel expenses. Opposition Liberal Democrats have slammed travel expenses at Winchester City Council. The council spent £143,181 on business travel last year, including nearly £105,000 on staff petrol mileage, £25,414 on public transport, £12,932 on councillors' mileage, and £46 on taxes for councillors. The details were revealed at a full council meeting after a question from Councillor Robert Hutchinson to finance portfolio holder Stephen Godfrey. But Councillor Godfrey defended the costs and said it was vital for officers to travel across the district. He said, "Officers need sensible arrangements to deliver services properly over a very large geographical area. We have seen a marked reduction in the cost of lease cars, and the cost of mileage is coming down significantly year on year."
garden impresses Mayor. A Winchester summer fete combined two essential summer ingredients last weekend. Glorious weather and a colourful garden. Flowerdown Care Home celebrated the opening of its new-look garden with its annual summer fete on Saturday. The Mayor and Mayoress of Winchester, Ernie and Barbara Jeffs, attended with the former officially opening the home's new flower beds. Councillor Jeffs said, "I came here last year to open the pond, and it's quite dramatic what they have done to put this garden together, and it looks stunning. I'm sure the residents here must treasure it." Friends of Flowerdown, a charity set up to support the home, has been working to transform the garden for months. Chairman Colin Kimber said he was delighted residents could enjoy the area. He said, "The project isn't over, and we want to build a new gazebo-type structure we can take residents into, and a new path around the garden. We haven't got a target as such, but money raised today will go to that to help that." Manager Sharon Tucker added, "This is not an institution, it's a home, and events like this are very popular with the residents. It allows us to bring the community and families in and bring normal life to the residents. Food, prizes and games were provided by Sainsbury's in Middlebrook Street, which has chosen Friends of Flowerdown as its annual charity partner.
Scheme is helping troubled families. More than 50 troubled families have been helped to turn their lives around in Hampshire within the first year of a new project. The County Council and partner agencies have identified 546 high-risk families in need of support. The aim of the government scheme is to challenge long-term unemployment, antisocial behaviour and truancy. Measures of success include parents or older siblings being helped back into work or training, improved school attendance and less youth crime. Councillor Keith Manns, Executive Lead Member for Children's Services, said, "We want to make sure we are making a really substantial improvement in the lives of families and not just ticking performance boxes. We expect more positive outcomes in the next 6 months." Speaking at a meeting of the full council, he said families who had been successfully helped were not removed from the project but still supported to sustain positive changes. About 150 families have a dedicated support worker who visits them regularly, in some cases daily, to provide more intensive support, including parenting. In addition, a multi-agency single family plan is in place for more than 500 families. The council is working with partner agencies such as district councils, the NHS and police to provide more coordinated support. The initiative is designed to help families with deep-rooted problems, including a history of drug and alcohol misuse. Councillor Manns said, "There is one family, one plan, one joined-up approach." He added, "I really believe this programme is a game-changer in the way we deal with families in need of support." He said local communities also benefited. Nationally, it is estimated that the costs of dealing with one troubled family by public bodies can cost £75,000 a year, and in the long term the scheme should save taxpayers' money. Estimated costs and savings will be evaluated by Portsmouth University over the 3 years of the project. The scheme is funded with £5.3 million from Whitehall and £1 million from the County Council. It aims to help 1,590 families across Hampshire by March 2015.
Pair willing to give new venture a try. England's rugby union captain was in town last week to look over his new business venture. As previously reported, Chris Robson has teamed up with best friend and former Hampshire cricketer Kevin Latouf to open a coffee and wine bar in Winchester's Jury Street, opposite the Discovery Centre. Mr. Robson said he was looking forward to having a different focus outside of rugby. Mr. Lertouf, who lives in Chandler's Ford, said that the venture would employ 15 people, and he hoped it would give the area a lift, as the unit has remained empty for 3 years. The pair hope to open black, white, red next month, subject to their application being approved by city licensing chiefs.
Village goes quackers for duck race. Mearnstoke was invaded by a flotilla of plastic ducks as residents clambered around the edges of the River Mearn to peer over bridges to get a good look at the action. The Great Duck Race set off near the Buck's Head pub, and the annual event saw the children's race won by Caitlin Humphreys, beating all comers, and she raised her plastic duck in triumph. Later in the day, it was the turn of the adults. All funds raised will go to charity. And this is accompanied by a colour photograph showing the villagers, young and old, clambering around the stream and pointing out their particular duck as it floated along the stream towards the winning post, we hope.
Border agency in raid on city restaurant. A Winchester restaurateur could face a £10,000 fine after an immigration raid on his business last week. Seven armed immigration enforcement officers attended the Bangkok Brasserie in Jury Street at around 7 p.m. last Friday, arresting a 29-year-old Thai woman. The woman, who is here on a student visa taking an MA in marketing at Winchester University, was detained as the conditions prohibit her from working. Mif Kayum, who runs the restaurant, said he believed she was eligible as a previous visa allowed her to work in 2010. He said, "I feel very silly because it's a mistake I made. She was here in 2010 on a student visa that allowed her to work, and when it expired, she left the country. She got another student visa, and on this one, there are two small words, work prohibited, but I assumed that it was the same situation again. She has invested around £60,000 in the UK economy through studying over here and has been arrested for working a part-time job on 10 hours per week." Mr. Kayum added he had applied for a licence to grant work permits for foreign nationals, which involved two home office visits to inspect his files in January and June, including the arrested woman's. He added, "I have paid the Home Office £2,000 to advise me and make sure I have the correct paperwork. You would think these people would have picked up that there is a person with an incorrect visa working for me." A spokesman for the border agency confirmed, "There was an intelligence-led visit conducted at the Bangkok Brasserie in Jury Street, Winchester, last Friday. A 29-year-old woman, a Thai female, was arrested for working in breach of her visa conditions. She was detained, and the case is currently being progressed. A notice of potential liability was served on the employer." Mr. Kayum owns three restaurants in Winchester: Bangkok Brasserie, Bengal Sage and Kyoto Kitchen, and employs 45 people.
Man beaten in late night assault in city centre. Winchester man was taken to hospital after a late night attack in the city. Police are appealing for witnesses after the 48-year-old was assaulted in the Broadway on Sunday, July the 28th, between 1 a.m. and 1:20 a.m. He was taken to the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, where he was treated for facial injuries. The victim was walking home with a friend when they were approached by another man outside the Guild Hall. Two other men appeared, and they began kicking the victim before all three walked off towards King Alfred's statue. The suspects are all described as white. One was 30 to 40 years old, chubby, around 5 foot 10 inches, with blonde hair shaved at the back and sides. PC Mike Good said the area would have been busy at the time of the incident, with people enjoying a night out or making their way home. The assault occurred next to the taxi rank, and I'm especially keen to hear from any taxi drivers who may have seen the incident.
How's that? MP put on the back foot at club. Steve Bryan stepped up to the crease when he visited a cricket club last week. The Winchester and Chancellorsford MP was at Compton and Chancellorsford Cricket Club's annual cricket camp as it drew to a close. Organiser and chief coach Bill Brown has been a member of the club in its different forms for the past 20 years and said the camp has more than one benefit. We have done this for about 5 years, and word of mouth gets out that we're there at the start of the school holidays. Parents get their kids over to us, and it's been a good babysitting service for the mums too, he said. The club is the result of a merger between Compton and Shawford Cricket Club and Chancellorsford Cricket Club. Mr. Bryan stopped by to show his support. He said, "This is a great little cricket club, and it makes every sense to bring Compton and Chancellorsford together in this way. I saw some promising cricketers when I visited, so let's hope there's a future England star in our midst." But Mr. Bryan won't be expecting a call for the England selectors any time soon, according to Mike Richardson, the club president. He said he fitted in very well, and he bowled and he batted, but he's not the best. He's a golfer, he said, and he got some stick from the lads. Four coaches were on hand to help the youngsters with their skills during the sessions, which ran from Monday to Friday. Three of the coaches came up through the system from the Colts, and that's very gratifying indeed, said Mr. Richardson. And there's a colour photograph showing Steve Bryan standing at the crease, bat raised, waiting for the inevitable ball, and around him, young and old, merrily cheering him on and seemed very, very happy indeed.
Will consult over the loss of open space. Civic chiefs have pledged to soften the blow on the impact of residents losing open space to housing. The City Council is more than a year into a 10-year plan to build 300 homes across the city, including controversial schemes to build on parkland and a playground in Abbots Barton and Wick, respectively. Speaking at a full council meeting, Councillor Anne Weir, who represents Wick, said, "What assurances will you give residents affected by the loss of open space that funds will be available to carry through any proposed mitigation?" Leader Keith Woods said that steps would be taken to make up for any loss of space, but that, quote, "a tremendous amount of consultation," unquote, took place on these schemes. He said, "I think that where land is being taken for housing, then we will try to mitigate loss of open space. Consultation is important, and I think it's something we should do properly. But we can't go on consulting forever. There comes a point where a decision has to be made." Councillor Ian Tate, former portfolio holder for New Homes Delivery, added there should be a balance between maintaining open space and providing affordable homes to tackle the waiting list. He said, "The principle of delivering affordable housing is so important that there will be occasions where the council will consider the loss of open space in favour of the housing."
Okay. Steam trains back on the track. Steam trains resume running again on the Watercrest line after fears over a fire risk caused a four-week break. The railway was concerned that sparks from engines could cause serious fires along the track from Alresford to Alton because of the hot weather and tinder dry ground. Since July the 12th, the Heritage Railway has run trains pulled by diesels. Colin Chambers, Chief Executive, said, "We have had a couple of fires this summer, and if a fire spread onto farmland of ripening corn, the farmers would send us their bills for the crops."
King Alfred Bones Probe Step Nearer. Permission for analysis of the bone that may be King Alfred the Great has moved a step closer. The Hyde 900 community group has formally applied for permission to study the bones, which were exhumed amid secrecy from St. Bartholomew's Church in Hyde in March. A final decision by the Chancellor of the Diocese of Winchester is now expected within a few weeks.
And this piece I have here, I'll just describe the photograph before I go on to read the piece, and it'll become clear then. It's a photograph of, I've just been counting them, and it's over 100 young people raising their arms and cheering on the top of a hill. And the title of this is Youngsters Reach Their Peak. More than 100 young people took to the hills to raise money for some of their 50 youth groups and centres, which are supported by Hampshire charity Youth Options. The youngsters took on the Three Peaks Challenge by climbing the three biggest hills in Hampshire: Beacon Hill, Old Winchester Hill and Butser Hill. Sarah Collinson from Youth Options said, "It's great that these young people showed a determination not only to complete the challenge, but also to raise money for their centres."
Barbershop Chorus makes money for mayor. And I'm being encouraged not to sing this item. A Winchester Barbershop Chorus has been helping the mayor raise money for his charities. The Tudor Roses performed for Mayor and Mayoress Ernie and Barbara Jeffs when they held a charity cake sale in the Cathedral Close on Saturday before last. The 35-strong chorus sing unaccompanied in the barbershop style. It meets for rehearsal every Monday from 7:30 at All Saints Church Hall in Highcliffe. New members are always welcome. The Mayor's Cake Sale raises funds for Hounds for Heroes, Network Scouts, Countess Manbatten House, and a community pot for various good causes, including Alsford and District Guiding, Alsford Community Centre, Alsford Town Trust Minibus and Alsford Rugby Club.
And on that cheerful note, we end our extracts for the week. Our thanks to our editors, Jean Carswell, Ken Clemenson and Barbara Chase, and to our various technical teams. And thanks to our readers, Margot Meredith.
Goodbye.
John Richards.
Goodbye.
And Peter Lydiard.
Goodbye.
And from me, John Parker, goodbye. Have a good week. And please return the memory stick as soon as you're able, not forgetting to put your address label inside the envelope.